there was attempts of suicide.
What happened there, mate? Do you mind talking about that?
I used to get the thoughts about wanting to end my life because of how dark it was, how negative it was, that, and all the chaos I've caused, and not knowing no way out. I used to tell myself it's just better that I'm not here. It's just better for everyone that I'm not here. So I wasn't a very nice person at all. I ended up in psychiatric units, and even in there, I'd be asking for more medication. I'd be seeing what other people were on, and I'd be asking them, "How'd you get that?"
Yeah, what's the strongest thing to just stop me from?
I want some. Yeah, you know. And even the psychiatrist said to me, "This ain't the place for you."
Because they knew this was addiction rather than something else.
Must have done, yeah.
Yeah.
Because now I'm sitting here thinking, now what? And they'd let me out, and I'll just, as soon as I get out, I'll take a drink again. End up back in there.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. On today's episode, we feature George, who is a recovered addict and alcoholic of 3.5 years. He talks about the last 5 years of his addiction and alcoholism, about just residing to the fact he's just going to carry on drinking and using, and he can't find a way out. Even though people on the outside are telling him that there is help, he couldn't see it himself. After George was put into a rehab, he found a 12-step program and worked really hard to get sobriety. Some consequences of his past caught up with him at 2 years sober, and he was put into jail. But upon arrival in jail, he asked to be put onto a wing, a rehab wing, where he could help people. And that's what he did. So he survived jail by helping other people. George has really turned his life around, which is a wonderful podcast to listen to. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. George, thank you so much for coming on. This is Powerful. I really appreciate you coming in, mate.
Thank you very much.
Looking forward to our conversation. I'd love to ask straight off how sober you are.
3 years, 5 months.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Miracle.
It's fucking fantastic, mate. For our audience, where are you from and how is your upbringing?
So I'm from East London, Romford. My mum was from Acne, and my dad was from South London, Mitcham. My mum's the most amazing mum in the world, and she's done so much for me through my life, and still continues now. You know, she's an amazing woman. My dad ain't no longer here. He had an aneurysm in 2020.
Oh wow, sorry about that.
Yeah,
mate.
The upbringing was all right. They had kids from previous relationships, and so I was always the younger one, the blue-eyed boy, you know what I mean?
For your mum's eyes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. My dad used to drink. There was moments of, in the household, there was moments of arguments and stuff like that, you know what I mean? And
was this when he was drinking or just general life?
Both, yeah, both. It was both when he was drinking, or there'd be arguments, and I was just always petrified, you know what I mean? Even from a young kid, I just used to be really petrified.
Of your dad or just in general?
Of general, yeah. Do you know what? I used to suffer with bad, bad panic attacks and anxiety and doom, pending doom. Like, and I'd be so consumed with it, I feel like I'm going to die. And that's like at the age of 12. I think something horrific's going to happen to me. It was, I even used to wet the bed when I was about 8. You know what I mean? I'd go to sleep, wake up, and I've wet the bed. I still don't know really why now, but I don't know if it was because of all that stuff from the beginning, my thinking.
It probably didn't help, did it?
Because it was just constant negative thinking all the time, you know?
Did your parents know about your thinking, or was that just you kept it internal?
That they know now since I've been in recovery, because it's that stuff, isn't it? When I was growing up, I didn't want no one to know how I really felt or the things that I thought. And people, all through my life, I'd be trying to put this mask on and portray to the outside world that I'm all right. I can deal with stuff. I'm confident. I'm this, I'm that. I'm really inside. I didn't feel that.
I know exactly what you mean. It's a weird one to say because you are a good-looking fella. You're obviously well-built and fit and stuff, and it's... You can take... A lot of us judge people on how they look.
Mm.
And you look like someone that would be confident and sure of yourself, and people used to say that to me. And I used to get really annoyed because inside, I felt like shattered glass. And you can't walk into a pub or go to work on a building site or do it, or say to people, this is how I feel. It's difficult. I think it's changing now, which is a good thing. But then it would have been more... It's like being a wound-up coil, isn't it? Because you can't be yourself and you're putting on this show and this front. So when you talked about panic attacks, George, at 12, it's a pretty horrific thing for anyone who knows what a panic attack is to go through. Was that addressed or did that carry on for quite some time?
Yeah, I ended up going to the doctors and at a young age, and even my sister spotted it before anyone else, you know what I mean? And to go on in life, I just continued as I was, because as far back as I can remember now, by looking back, that was constantly there. So to me, at that age, to feel like that, to think like that was normal.
Yeah.
And no, in a way, no, I never got addressed. It just, I took drink and drugs.
When did you take your first drink?
It was around my sister's. It went from playing Monopoly at the age of 12 to a Shandy, Foster's Shandy. And then it went onto the Foster cans. And I was sneaking them out the fridge, you know. And
did you get, like, a Shandy's quite a refreshing drink, isn't it? It's not really going to cause too much trouble. But when you take Foster's, that's a different game at 12. Did you immediately get an effect where you was like, I like this feeling? I actually feel better than I did without it.
I knew the difference straight away, you know, and I was like, that's really good. That's really good. And it ended up in blackout that night, you know, and I was in a terrible state the next morning. I didn't remember much of it. And evidently I was sneaking them out of the fridge.
As you do.
Yeah. No one to know.
Yeah. Well, this stuff makes me feel good, so why wouldn't I take it? And did you, 12's hard to think about it, but did you think, oh, my dad drinks, I know why he drinks, or was it just, this feels good and I'm going to have some?
That's a good question, because, you know, like, when I was young, I used to see what alcohol and drugs done to people, and even my dad. You know what I mean? And I knew that it's bad.
Yeah.
It's bad for you. And even all that stuff, I swore I'd never be this and I'd never turn out like that. And that's where it took me from that in the beginning. Because like Special Brew and Tenants and all stuff like that.
Did that come on? Did you start buying it, or did you meet other people that was drinking? Because that was obviously your sister's house.
Yeah, my dad used to drink that Tenants and Special Brew, you know. But as the years went on with me, it just progressed stronger and stronger and stronger stuff, you know, and vodka and.
Did this do anything with the panic attacks whilst you was drinking from that age?
Yeah. Yeah, when I took drink and drugs, it removed every bit of thinking.
What was the drug you took first?
See, I tried weed when I was at school, and I can remember playing Mario and Donkey Kong on the Nintendo when I was young, and I remember smoking this weed when I was at school, and I greened that in the classroom. And I just remember having my head on the table and I see Mario and Luigi running through my vision. You know what I mean? I was like, nah, I'm not doing that again, you know? Getting in with a crowd down the field, smoking and smoking cigarettes, bunking off school, drinking. Because I used to look at people who sniff cocaine and I think that's disgusting. You know what I mean? Yeah. Drugs are bad. But then that night come when someone offered me some cocaine and I sniffed it.
What age was that?
I'd say it's probably about 18 year old.
How did this affect your schooling in the meantime? Because if you're bunking off and stuff, did you just give up on school? Or?
Yeah, for me, school, I was just petrified constantly. I'd be embarrassed when women, girls at the time, you know, when I'd be in the classroom, they'd be making fun of me, Georgie, Paulgie, all that stuff. And I'd be so embarrassed, the feelings what I'd feel inside, you know?
Yeah.
And I want to get out of the classroom. And if I did go out of the classroom, I wouldn't want to go back in there because now what they think about me, I'd be so embarrassed. And
it's powerful, isn't it? Because you don't, when you don't have the tools, and especially at that age, when if you are afflicted with addiction or you have, you're very sensitive to things, right? And I had that as well. And it would be easier for me to remove myself from a situation than to confront it. And I think the wonderful thing in recovery for me is that I have the tools to talk now. And before it was 0 to 100.
Mm.
I'd either be hiding, wouldn't be able to explain myself, or just want to walk away, not want to go anywhere. I'd be really fucking angry. And I couldn't have a discussion. I couldn't take anything. And I think that's really difficult when you're younger. Do you think that helps to fuel addiction?
Definitely. Because I know now that I was constantly trying to find release. Oblivion, not to feel all that emotional stuff, you know, and to escape my own head and the constant thoughts and the turmoil within, you know what I mean? It was just an ongoing thing all the time. And because even at school, I'd see people outside the front gate and I'd think, they're going to beat me up, like in my head. This is the age of like 13, 14.
Yeah.
They're going to beat me up. So then I want to escape out the back way to not go out the front.
It's like a hyper-awareness, isn't it?
Yeah, because I started thinking things and then I believe them to be true, you know?
Yeah.
It becomes reality for me. But as I said, the drinking drugs in the early days took all that away, you know?
Did you have any allies at that time? Any of the guys you hung around with that were in the same boat, they felt the same or acted the same?
See, that's another thing, because I'd always look at other people and say that I'm better behaved than them and I don't do them things and all that sort of stuff, you know. But no, for me, when I was young, the upbringing, I'll just see how you go through this world is you don't tell no one how you're feeling. You don't show your weakness is, you know what I mean, the weaknesses.
Yeah.
And don't be vulnerable. Because then people can use that against you and all that stuff.
Well, that's literally a standard thing, isn't it? I think it's changing now again, like I said, but that was a standard thing. When were you brought up in the 80s?
88, I was born, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, and it would have been, yeah, you can't say this because you'll get advantages taken out of you and stuff like that. So it's hard, isn't it? Because you're told to suppress yourself, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
When did you leave school?
16 I was.
You literally run out of the gate, Sam. Thank you.
I did, yeah. 16. That went on to college. I'd done college. And as all this stuff was unfolding, I was meeting with other groups of people. They used to take drink and drugs. And I started really to feel at ease. You know what I mean? I really started to feel at ease. And
as in, like, you found your crew that's doing the same thing.
Yeah. Going out partying every weekend. But even that, like, I used to come Monday morning and I wouldn't have no money again. I think, look, because I had a job as well at that time.
What was you doing?
Landscaping, paving.
Okay. What was you studying at college?
Plumbing.
Okay.
Yeah, plumbing. But because I messed about at school, didn't really get good grades. I found it hard to get an apprenticeship and all that stuff, you know. But it'd be like Monday morning, I've been out again, I ain't got no money. I'd swear to myself, I'm going to have a weekend off. Then Thursday comes, and then suddenly it's a good idea again, you know. 18, 19, 20. And by this point, only by looking back now and being in recovery, can I see that all that fear and anxiety and panic, what I felt from being bullied or thinking that I'm being bullied and scared, it was, then I become violent. Because I realised that I didn't have to feel that way anymore.
Mm.
But then that required action for me to do. Be violent, you know? And
was that with the guys you was hanging around with outside on the weekends, that kind of thing, or?
Yeah, because I was good at thinking what they want me to be.
Yeah.
And then doing that, you know, whether it was going to harm me or there was consequences or just to validation, to fit in, to be accepted, you know, to be part of something, to be liked.
Yeah.
Because how I felt from young, I didn't feel loved. It didn't mean that I wasn't loved, because I was. You know what I mean? I was loved. But it's just the way I felt internally, you know?
It's really interesting. You basically described that Gabor Mate says it very clearly, that it's not the addiction, it's what it does for the person. You know, what is the actual real cause? Why are they using? What are they taking away? What pain are they taking away? Mm-hmm. You know, I think you just described it really clearly. I think that's a misconception of people that have addiction problems, is that they are pretty much in emotional mental pain most of the time. And they find something that relieves it. But also there's the behaviour, right? Like you said, people pleasing.
Yeah.
Doing what you think people want you to do to be accepted. Where did that go? All the violence and stuff?
As we know, it got worse. You know what I mean? It got worse. Because there was always consequences from nights out, from my drinking. Oh, I was never there. I ended up meeting a girl and I was just never there emotionally. And to be fair, I didn't know how to be.
Was this still in 18, 19
period? Yeah. Going out partying all the time, as I said. And the justifications and the excuse making and the lies, you know what I mean? To go out and party again, your hair down. Because that's all I thought I was doing. I was having a good time. I was having a party. Going here, going there. All the excitement from it, the drink, the drugs.
But that's what it would have been, though. When you think, if you was, you know, you come from a place where you're having panic attacks when you're 12 and all of a sudden you found your flow and it's exciting and everyone's on the same page, you're going out, you're sharing laughs and good nights or whatever it is, bit of drama.
Yeah.
So it would relate to being ideal, really, wouldn't it?
It was like liberation. When I took a drink and drug, it was like liberation. All I'd have to do is take a drink and drug and I'd go places. And really, I'm just in the same spot. But I'd go places within, you know. My perception on life would change. And I'd be able to live manageably, you know. But on the other hand, I did try making a go at life. I really did. I always wanted to be a good person, to be accountable, to turn up, to show up, and to do my best, you know. But this is where I started seeing problems.
Did you graduate from college?
Yeah, I got level one and level two.
Oh, okay.
In plumbing, yeah. But then just ended up doing the landscaping. The problems was arising, and these people I started to take drink and drugs with in the beginning, they slowly started going this way. I'd be wanting them to go out partying and...
So they sort of straightened out and started...
Yeah. And they'd be like, no, I've got work in the morning. But at that time, I still believe I had control, because there was some periods when I'd, like, maybe throughout the week, be able to leave it alone, not go out, you know what I mean, on a weeknight. But then after a little while, it was creeping into the weeknights. And it's mad because... Yates is down Romford. It was like a pound a drink on Thursday nights. In my head, I'm like, oh, it's a pound a drink. It's a lot cheaper for a night out. So that, therefore, that justifies me to go out on a Thursday.
Yeah.
So now I'm waking up for Friday for work, I feel rough, real rough, you know, and I just go out again all weekend. The same old pattern. And as I said, these people I used to party with, they started turning up for life. There was a Canterbury there. They started having children and relationships, obviously, and they could put the partying aside, you know. But for me, that started becoming the first and foremost, you know what I mean? The necessity, really.
Did you look at them as being boring? And like abandoning you?
Yeah.
Like, we had something good going on here, fellas. What the hell are you doing?
What's the matter with these lot?
Yeah.
Don't they want to go out and have a good time?
Yeah.
You know? But it's that time when I'm not drinking and taking drugs. I feel alone. I feel apart from, you know, fear, worry, panic.
Yeah.
Anger.
And was that all the time when you weren't on drink or drugs?
Yeah.
So basically you're either high or low.
Yeah.
And nothing in between, right?
Frustration. Unsatisfied.
Yeah.
Ungrateful. All that stuff, you know? And when I take that drink and drug again, I'm just like, you know?
That's the thing that people don't realise, I think, that it's such a powerful substance, alcohol, to change the way you feel. I mean, it's pretty crazy, really. And if someone feels and thinks in that way, there's almost no option at one point, is there? What's the other solution? Until you find recovery, you know? No one would tell you that, would they?
Because even by that age, Paul, I was like 23 and I remember buying these gold labels and the little gold cans. And as I cracked it open and guzzled it back, it was like, oh. Because at that point, the drink's suddenly getting stronger and stronger and stronger.
Yeah.
Because what them Fosters done for me at the age of 12, they're no longer hitting the spot. I'm getting stronger and stronger and stronger in the percentage of drink, you know.
Were you drinking at work at this point, or was it still? Could you still wait till after?
I could still wait until after, and see, I see people getting on with their life, and I was like, I really need to make a go of this now. This is because for me to have a drink, it was justifiable, like because in my head it was socially. It was socially acceptable to just have a drink. Had an hard day at work, go home and have a drink. Stressed out, have a drink. You know what I mean? And at that point, the age of 23, 24, I managed, I don't know how, but to leave drinking and drug taking alone.
Did you?
For a short period, yeah. I was concentrating on work, working like a maniac, if I'm honest.
So that kind of replaced?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as I said, all that frustration, the worry, the thinking, my emotions, that was all still in turmoil inside me, you know. But because I'm really fixating on work and trying to make a go of something and not having getting a mortgage at the age of 25, moved area because it's these people, I don't want to be around these people who's dragging me back in. But now I can see that it was me all the time, you know, me putting myself back to that.
Do you think that's a common thing? Because I've seen it quite a lot and I've experienced it myself, that when I've decided that, okay, I'm going a bit too wrong here, I need to be more responsible about my job, I become like work obsessed, money obsessed. I wasn't happy, but I was driven. And on the outside, you'd think, God, he's driven. He's got, you know, I spoke quickly, I moved quickly, I did what I needed to do with perfection. But I was deeply unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite an interesting thing that when people just say, I'm going to stop drinking, if they are afflicted with addiction or alcoholism and they go work, they work really well and obsessed, but they leave the families alone, leave their friends alone. It's all about the money. So it's still not a happy environment, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And when I do look back, it's I couldn't do nothing moderately. like with that balance. As you said, it was either up here to the extremes or it was down to the lows, you know, and I'd either be all in or all out. There was no, and the times I've told myself and my family that I'm really going to make a go of it, this is what I'm going to try and do, and maybe I'd have short periods of that, and then all of a sudden it's back with a vengeance. I'm taking drugs again and drinking, lying about it, how much I have drunk, and even at this point I thought I sussed it. I thought I can work and drink at the same time. Nobody'll know. I keep it quiet, you know? And that went on for about 6 months. Because then the morning drinking started as well. Because I wake up, I feel a bit rough. Not a bit rough, very rough to be fair. Because I even tried 5 bottles of rosé one night and I thought, well, that's all right. It's nice and light, isn't it? You know what I mean? And I remember discovering the morning drink. Because even at that point, my dad even used to say to me, he said, you can't wake up straight away and drink that or smoke weed. And I used to say, it doesn't matter what time of the day it is, does it? Which in a way, I suppose I was right, but it's like all my family could start seeing problems. You know what I mean? That the drink and drug taking is going to extremes now.
When you took the first drink in the morning, was you still seeing that as, oh, this is perfect. This will take away the way I'm feeling and enhance it. And was there any point you thought, actually, it's a pretty bad idea to start drinking in the morning because now I'm round the clock?
Because, it's like self-medicating. Suddenly I can turn up for life. And it's in a little can. And I can get it from any off-licence. Wherever I go on my daily travels, I can just get it. Go in the shop and buy it, you know?
It's like the magic potion.
Yeah.
How long did that last before that started to have consequences, though, George? Because that obviously can't last for a long time. And everyone's... I know we've, you know, you think, I've got this sus, no one's going to see, but everyone knows.
Yeah.
How long did that last for drinking at work?
Not very long. As I said, I had that like 6 months period and then my behaviour is, people start noticing the behaviour. The fellow I worked for at the time, he'd be following me around the job, but he said, I can smell alcohol, you know, and I'll be saying, well, I had a few beers last night, but I hadn't, I'd only just drunk one, you know, and all them delusions in my mind that I've got it sussed, they don't know, when the fact is people could see it, and I'd just lie, come up with excuses or justifications, and I'd be like, the thought would cross my mind, maybe if I go round to this house while I'm meant to be working, or if I just stop at that pub on my lunch break, and then I just won't turn up for work. You know? I just won't turn up at all.
And what happened after that 6 month period then? Was there a change?
Yeah, massively. It was like next stages of alcoholism, you know? And I really try to, but then I'd substitute one drink for another drink or one drug for another drug, trying to find a balance whereby I can live.
Yeah, function, but not feel.
Yeah, yeah.
And not think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Without no consequences.
And how did that test go?
Horribly wrong. Horribly wrong. And it's mad when, isn't it? Mad when you look back, Paul, how, see, because I was the last one to see it. I was the last one to see it. And people would be saying, you've got a drink problem. And I'd just deny it. constantly deny it, you know? I ain't that bad, I can take it or leave it. Because in my head, if I left it alone for a couple of days, I haven't got a problem.
Yeah. That's a common thing. Because it's easy to put down a drink, but it's not easy to stay putting it down, is it? It's easier to pick it up after a while. And there's that sentence that would probably go through your mind that's like, oh, well, I ain't drunk for a couple of days, so deserve one, or it's all right to have one now, isn't it? And then you're off and running again, right?
Because even that, my whole life I'd be waiting for people to offer me to go out for a bit or drink or whatever. And because then it's justified. They've asked me. Really, I'm thinking about drinking all the time, even though my relationship's broke down. I've lost the mortgage, you know.
As that was happening, were you just carrying on and kind of putting your head in the sand?
Yeah. Even deeper, even harder.
Yeah.
Turn into more drinking drugs, you know.
Did you manage to work at that point, or were then you just not working?
I got to the age of 28, and by this point, it's more or less daily drinking, taking drugs. Suicidal thoughts, because I moved area. I went to Hertfordshire. I got into another relationship, and had another little girl. Due to all this drinking and drug taking and my behaviours, that relationship broke down as well, you know. And it was just everywhere I went, I'd mess things up. I'd mess things up and cause harm. And at this point, I'm getting moments of clarity of what how I'm going through life and what keeps happening. And the disappointment on people's faces and the fear of my family when they just look at me. Like, what is he going to do next? You know, and
in these moments of clarity, were you thinking, okay, I'm way deep here. I need to stop. I need to change something. Did that happen? Like, when was the first time that happened, and what did you do about it?
There was moments of that, but then I just could not see no other way to live without medicating myself and all the guilt. And the shame of the upset what I've caused through my life, you know. But then I'll just go harder at it to not have memories of all that stuff and trying to block it all out. And
on the back of a bottle of beer, it doesn't say when this stops working, go to rehab or go to a meeting or go to a therapist or try and find some sort of recovery. And on the back of a wrap of cocaine, it doesn't say when it stops working, you just get another one, don't you? It just keeps going and going and going and going. And I think that's hard to see when people look on the outside and they can see someone destroying their life. It makes no sense whatsoever, but they're not on the internal journey. And like you said, having all the anxiety, because that's what I had, all the anxiety, all the fear, then the shame came, then the guilt came, and it's just too much to comprehend. So the only choice is to push it down with a drink or a chemical. And that's why I think I had this epiphany one day when I was sitting there going through sentences, what people say, and, you know, a common one would be, oh, I want to get out of my head, or I was out of my nut last night, or I was getting out of my box, or whatever the phrase is. And I thought, why do I want to get out of it? Like, if I want to be out of my head, I don't like being in it. What is in it that I don't like? And I wrote it all down, what I didn't like, all the stuff you said. And I'm like, well, how do you get rid of that? Like, and if you get rid of that, can you live with yourself? You know, which is what my experience is, what recovery is. So how further down the road did you go, mate, and before you decided to come in, or was you, how did you come into recovery?
Something's just come to me when he was talking about the cans of beer and the wraps and that. Because I'd look on the front of the special brew can and it says, please drink responsibly. And in my head, I'd be thinking, because I wanted to seek oblivion and to block everything out. But also, there was times when I wished I could just control or moderate it, my usage. But for me, my experience there, that was long, long, long lost years ago, you know. But couldn't see that I'm never going to be able to regain control over this addiction, alcoholism. And I endured that for another about 5 years, day in, day out, wanting to kill myself day in, day out, alone. And people was trying to help me. People was trying to get me back on board and up. It just felt like I was out in the desert. You know what I mean?
It's a long time, 5 years, isn't it? To be enduring that.
Yeah, because there was attempts of suicide.
What happened there, mate? Do you mind talking about that?
Yeah. I used to get the thoughts about wanting to end my life because of how dark it was, how negative it was, that, and all the chaos I've caused, and not knowing no way out from all the damage what I've done to my life and to others' lives, and having no control over what's going to happen next. You know what I mean? And I used to tell myself it's just better that I'm not here. It's just better for everyone that I'm not here. So I wasn't a very nice person at all. I ended up in psychiatric units. And even in there, I'd be asking for more medication. I'd be seeing what other people were on, and I'd be asking them, how'd you get that?
Yeah, what's the strongest thing to just stop me from?
I want some, yeah, you know? And even the psychiatrist said to me, this ain't the place for you. This is not the place for you.
Because they knew this was addiction rather than something else.
Must have done, yeah.
Yeah.
Because now I'm sitting here thinking, now what? And they'd let me out, and I'll just, as soon as I get out, I'll take a drink again, end up back in there.
Is that because the police just picked you up and...
Sometimes I admit myself in there, sometimes it was section. It was a dark place to be in at the time, you know, and to experience that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And by this point, physically, I'm addicted to alcohol as well. The withdrawals, shaking, sweating, seeing things, having seizures.
Yeah.
And this is how insane alcoholism and drug addiction is, you know, and I know I'm going to die. I just know I'm going to die. And my poor mum, she'd be ringing the ambulance because I've had another seizure, and the ambulance crew are coming. I'd be wanting to take more drink and drugs while they're there. If you're going to admit me to hospital, I need some more of this.
Need to get prepared for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I'd be pleading for my life in the back of the ambulance. Please save me. And they'd take me in there to put me on some drips, and after a couple of hours, I'm thinking about drinking and taking drugs again. Because there may be some left indoors what I didn't actually get to take. Or I can get one on the way, a nice big bottle of vodka on the way back, you know. After all that horrific situation, what's just happened, you know? Just to walk out there again and to take another drink and drug. And as I said, to watch the fear come over your family's faces.
Yeah.
Must have been horrific for them, you know, because they knew it was coming again.
It's really hard to explain to people the when you're actually addicted to something, because people use the word, oh, I'm addicted to chocolate. You're not. When you're withdrawing from something and you have to have it again to put in your body to feel some form of normality, control, anything, it's really hard for people who haven't experienced it to understand that, right?
Yeah, because only by being in recovery has it been explained to me, and I've gone through the process of the 12 steps by someone else who's recovered from alcoholism or drug addiction, you know, and that craving inside me, once I was to take a substance, it is beyond my mental control to stop. And that means any loved ones, any consequences, anything, I cannot stop. Even if I want to, I can't stop. But then I've got the mind, which will take me back to it, you know?
Yeah.
Time and time again.
After that time in hospital, after that time, it sounds pretty bad and you're still craving to get vodka or whatever on the way home. What was the last point that made the decision that I need to be in recovery, or how to find recovery, or did someone say, George, there's a thing called recovery?
They did. Because even at that point, they give me detoxes, and I can remember them giving me medication in the hospital. I said, what does this do? And they said, read the leaflet. So I read the leaflet and it says it's going to stop the craving. So now I think I'm fixed. So I've rung all my family. This is it. So I've been physically detoxed from alcohol and drugs for a week. On that week detox, within 2 days, I'm drinking and taking drugs again, you know, and it was such a dark, lonely place. And by this time, I say, is it odd or is it God? I believe in God of my own understanding, you know, what the 12 steps has enabled me to find and to live by, you know. So I'm sitting at my mum's. She's gone out because she's constantly on suicide watch. You know what I mean? And I'm sitting there, and by this time, there's my niece's fella. He's been with my niece for like 3 years, maybe. And he kept coming round. And in my head, I'm thinking, what does he keep coming around pestering me for? You know what I mean? And he said, listen, I was like this, you know? I was like that. I said, but there's a way out. Straight away in my head, I'm thinking, you're nothing like me. You're nothing like me. Perhaps you might have had a little drink or drug problem, but I'm beyond help. No, I'm beyond help. But that little seed where he planted, and the pain and the darkness while I continued to endure, suddenly that seed started growing. And I was engaging with the drink and drug services because I got the chance in 2016 to engage with them. And I remember going in there thinking, I'm not as bad. I haven't done this yet. I don't inject. I don't do this drug. I don't do that drug. You know, but that's just my mind playing tricks with me again.
It's a very smart way of the mind keeping you drinking and doing, because you still think you're not that bad, even though you just explained all the detoxes and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly that. And I got the chance again in I believe it was 2020, to start engaging again, you know. And lucky enough for me, I got a chance to go to rehab.
How was that, mate?
Scary, because I also suffered with that inside myself. How can I deal with life without that drink and drugs? Even though I know it's killing me, you know what I mean?
Did you hear anything in rehab? Like, when I went into rehab, I didn't know what was going on for the first couple of weeks. I was just doing what they was doing, and it was interesting what you said, because I still had that. There was one point, I've shared this before, where I knew I had a drug problem, but I thought drink's not quite there yet, because mm-hmm. I've got this friend who drinks a lot more. I've seen someone in my family drink a lot more. And we was doing a process group. For those who don't know, you sit around and you just honestly say how you feel at that time. And I remember them challenging me on drink. Cause I said, well, I don't have a drink problem, but I definitely have a drug problem. They said, you might want to look at that. And I said, you might want to look at it. I'm okay. And I ran out the door. I ran towards the pub. And on the way to the pub, I heard myself say, if I can just have a scotch or a drink or something, I'll be able to deal with what they're saying. And the penny dropped in mid-sprint. I was like, oh, God, they're actually right. I use something to deal with my thinking and to take the feelings away.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back sheepish, and that was my throwing the towel in. What was your throwing the towel in?
I believe I had certain spiritual experiences before getting to rehab. And I knew that it was my mind. It wasn't nothing to do with anyone in this world. Or the things that's happened over the past. I just knew it was my mind taking me back to that orders, because the last couple of years I was using against my will, I didn't want to be doing it, but all I'd keep doing was doing it.
Mm.
And the harder I tried not to do it, I'd do it more. And I just, in the end, I knew there was no control over it. What kept happening, you know? And exactly what you said, Paul. I remember it was in Bournemouth, I went to rehab, and my niece's fella took me. And still on that morning, I thought there's got to be another way. There's got to be another way, because the truth of the matter was I was scared.
Mm.
And my family simply looked at me and they said, there's no other way, George. The only other way is in a coffin. You know what I mean? For my family to say that to me. And I've been wanting so much to get to that rehab. Please just get me through the doors of that rehab.
Mm.
Didn't know what to expect. But yet still on that morning, my illness was trying to chat me out of it, you know. And lucky for me, I got there. They detoxed me, a week detox. Even I said to them, what's that pillar all about? It's like a mesh pillar. I said, that's in case you have a fit while you're like detoxing, yeah, and you still be able to breathe, you know. And for the first time, Paul, these people, I could relate to these people, you know. They shared their experience with me of exactly how it was from, with their life and their thinking and their drug taking and the consequences and how they felt. And suddenly in my head, it was like, because people just tell me, you're off your head.
Yeah.
And I'll be going, oh, no. You know, no one couldn't relate to no one through my life, because no one had a real answer.
When you heard these people that you could relate to and they could relate to you, was it a feeling of relief and that you found something here that may work?
Definitely. Definitely. I was still also scared, very scared. But here I see people living life, helping each other. Without the use of drink and drugs, you know, and they're telling me there's a way out and there's a way you can live. You don't have to ever have to feel that way again. Don't have to ever drink or use again. And it was a real beautiful experience, even though it was tough. Because when I turned up there, there was like, have you offered your room up? And in my head, I'm thinking, I've come here off my deathbed, mate. What do you mean over me room up? You know what I mean? Wash your plate up. Because all that stuff was long gone.
Yeah.
Simple things like that, you know? And they introduced me into the 12 steps. And that's why I'm sitting here today. That's why I'm still alive. Because I didn't have long left. I know that. Because even at the age of 33, I accepted death.
Yeah.
I really did. And I'll share a bit on this because I know this is, for me, this is so important as well. There was all consequences at the end of my drinking and drug taking, you know, beginning of 21, end of 2020. I was already engaging to go to rehab and all that stuff. And when I was at rehab, all these court cases was turning up, and I've never experienced prison before. And so grateful, so blessed to have found the 12 steps and the meetings and recovery, because I had two years of recovery. And then that day come when they sent me to prison, 2 years into recovery.
For stuff that had happened prior to recovery, yeah.
Yeah.
How was that to accept?
Only by being in recovery, it was all right, you know? Because I knew what I'd done. I knew I had to be accountable and also to make use of going in there by helping other people while I was in there, you know? It was a real experience for me.
How did you help other people when you went to prison?
First of all, I asked them if I could be placed where I could help people.
What was their reaction to that?
What? You know what I mean? And then when I did get there, I was like, it's chaos. But that
was that like a sober wing or rap wing, or
it was meant to be like, it was a detox wing, but it was more drug taking and alcohol and tablets and medication than there was detoxing, you know?
Yeah.
But to pass this 12 steps on to others, you know, and to take them through the process so then they can recreate their life and live a life.
So you had a positive purpose when you went in there?
Yeah.
And how was that whole process to do that?
It was scary, but I had faith that as long as I do what I've been shown to do in recovery, I'll be all right, you know? And that was my experience. I was all right. Because for me to go in somewhere like that, clean and sober, as I said years ago, all that stuff I suffer with, you know, all the worry, the anxiety. That'd
have been terrifying.
But to go into prison for a stretch and then to come out still intact, still clean and sober, and to have grown from that experience, you know? Yeah, it's just, I get emotional sometimes, you know? Real emotional.
I can imagine, yeah.
From where it was to what it's like now, it's, and what a gift.
What is it like now for our listeners that, you've gone through all that stuff in your life, been in out sailing asylums, hospitals, then prison, sober. And what is it like now?
What is it like now? I wake up with no desire to take drink and drugs. No desire to ruin my life. You know what I mean? To be of service to other people and to be a better person in this world, on this universe, you know, and to help others, most importantly, you know, to help others. And even by me doing what I'm doing, my family gets set free as well, you know, more and more and more.
That's an important point now, because people don't think about, we rob our families of peace of mind, security and stuff about us, and the worry, especially if you've got a wonderful mum, like you said, she just must be counting her blessings now.
Yeah. And it's a spiritual toolkit, what I take with me on my daily journey, you know?
Yeah.
To be self-aware, to observe my mind, to watch for it, because I was just driven by it my whole life.
Just on the spiritual toolkit, we're not talking about sandals here and a tambourine. What happened to me was that I felt pretty much dead inside, suicidal at points. Couldn't see the point of living. Everything was anxiety and nerves and stuff. And from working a program and doing lots of other processes and What I explain to people is that it's like when you have a child come up to you, they're full of life, they're full of spirit, their eyes are glinting, they're happy, they're enthusiastic, and that goes with addiction. And you become like a walking zombie, don't you? It just completely goes. And that comes back. And that's the bit for me, which is like the spirit. It's like a spirited horse. You have your spirit back.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing more for me to say than that, than it's not like levitating above the kitchen floor, banging tambourines, but it gives you life and gives you the opportunity to see what you're thinking. So you're not in the thinking because you're seeing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty amazing. George, I could talk forever. We're running out of time. But just one more question, mate. It's for our listeners who are either thinking about coming to recovery or they have a sibling or son or daughter that's in trouble. What should they do?
Reach out. Be honest on actually where you're at, how you feel, and ask for help. Find the helpline, get to a meeting, and get involved, you know, because as I said, recovery has saved my life. It saved my life. I can live comfortably in day-to-day living, you know?
Yeah.
Could never do that before. Could never do that. So if there is anyone listening, you're struggling, reach out, get the help while you can, you know. I'm so lucky to be here.
Yeah,
really am.
And I appreciate you being here, George. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Cheers. All good? Lovely. Didn't even look at him, mate. That was fucking terrific.
Yeah, brilliant. That means that's saying, oh, you fucking useless, George.
Nah, that was amazing. You're really good.
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Frederica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scofield.